Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, a little bit of retail, a little bit of Europe, and a question. How do you know you're wealthy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 9th of April, and we begin with an executive failure, a complete misapprehension of what happens in the mind of the American consumer. JCPenney CEO Ron Johnson has lost his job, as you might have heard, been unceremoniously kicked to the curb after a year-and-a-half long tenure that, well, it just didn't cut it. Johnson famously tried to break the cycle of marking up prices just to mark them down again. That way retailers have of constantly putting things on sale. Johnson's idea was to just have low prices every day, make things easier for the company and its customers. Thing is, customers quite literally didn't buy it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains why.
Let's jump into the life cycle of a V-neck dress on sale at JCPenney right now. Its color is Stardust, which apparently means purple in Penny's language. Original retail price, $60. The store likely paid less than half that, but it has stuck around too long, so it's time to put it on sale. Stacy Widlitz is a retail consultant.
The latest promotion that you would probably see nowadays is 20 off, probably within 4 weeks of when it hits the merchandising floor.
That's about where the dress is now, marked down to $50.
After that, they may mark it down again.
Getting a deal feels great. Kit Yarrow is a consumer psychologist at Golden Gate University.
They look at sales as a way of feeling like they've kind of gotten one over on the retailer, that for sure they've won.
JCPenney's rejection of sales made shoppers feel like losers all the time. The truth is, they always have been. At 20%, 30%, or even 50% off, a retailer can still make money. But consumers don't know that.
People are shopping with very little actual information about what the prices are, and so they're going to rely a lot on cues. And the most commonly used kind of cue is a discount.
University of Chicago marketing professor Jean-Pierre Dubé says JCPenney has taught its customers to expect just that cue.
Over the years, they've just been trained.
Among them, longtime JCPenney shopper Marianne Donahue, who didn't get it when the sales ended. Now, she's back.
I just had a coupon today at JCP, and that's what brought me in because it was an extra 20% off.
It's not that sales are mandatory for all businesses. Stores as different as Walmart and Apple have long stuck with stable prices. But once shoppers expect sales, anything less feels like a ripoff. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
From the annals of problematical corporate bankruptcies today comes Fisker Automotive. The maker of high-end hybrids is on what you might safely characterize as a bankruptcy watch. It's laid off most of its employees. It's hired Chapter 11 lawyers, the whole deal, greasing the skids for a filing maybe this week. But here's the rub. Fisker's not just risking investors' money. It's gotten taxpayer loans as well. And if it does go under, you can bet your bottom dollar that political Washington will be a lot less forgiving of high-tech failure than an entrepreneurial place like Silicon Valley might be. Scott Tong has that story from the Sustainability Desk.
Fisker owes the Energy Department nearly $200 million. The point of the loan was to lure private investors. Think of it as East Coast money attracting West Coast money. Thing is, the two coasts have vastly different stomachs for failure. Sam Jaffe is with Navigant Research.
The entrepreneur's motto is fail big and fail fast. And the government's motto is never, ever fail or else we're out of our jobs.
He says the West Coast mindset is, let's try it. A $100,000 car with a cool design, struggling with production problems, a dodgy battery supplier, a fire during testing. It happens. Joseph Lassiter at Harvard Business School says startup investors realize that most ventures fail quietly.
They don't announce successes until they're quite proven and the failures are kept quiet.
Except with Fisker, public money is on the line. So bring on the D.C. politicians to pounce on the Fisker quote-unquote mistake. This, of course, follows the failure of taxpayer-backed Solyndra. Dan Sperling teaches at UC Davis.
A few years ago, you know, in terms of the political environment, it probably made good sense to get the economy going, to support clean technology. Right now in Washington, that appetite has been greatly suppressed.
suppressed, even though one loan recipient, Tesla, is thriving, even though a free market Republican president started this program. The two coasts, they keep growing apart. Recently, automotive entrepreneurs spoke to federal auditors. They said negative publicity has made the Energy Department more risk-averse. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Gold gained 1% today, $1,587 an ounce at the close in New York, which is great and all, nice to know, but come on, kind of useless, right? Nobody actually walks into a store and throws down a $20 gold coin for a beer, right? No, most places they don't, but you might soon be able to in Arizona. A bill that makes gold and silver legal tender there is set to pass. The question, of course, is who's going to use the stuff? Marketplace's Peter O'Dowd reports now from Phoenix.
Republican State Senator Chester Crandall says people in Arizona with a little extra gold lying around will have an easier time spending it.
This gives them the ability to be able to use it as tender and have the same recognition as the paper dollar coming out of the Federal Reserve.
Crandall's bill models a law Utah passed in 2011. Gold broker Mike Rowland supports it. He says the precious metal protects against a U.S. dollar that's losing value because of the federal government's growing debt.
We know in a situation where we're at, they continue to pump money in, which eventually that game's going to end.
Still, putting gold to work will be complicated. For one thing, prices fluctuate rapidly. Rollins tosses a $50 gold piece on the table. At today's prices, he'd sell the coin for more than $1,500.
You're not buying a loaf of bread with that.
Plus,
what happens if I get a counterfeit gold coin?
Monica Heisenrader runs McAlpine's, a boutique in Phoenix full of expensive vintage sofas. She can't afford to get scammed.
$800 to $1,000 on a purchase of a piece of furniture, that'll hurt a lot.
There is talk of repositories where people can deposit gold and then draw down the balance with a debit card. But how that will work is still unclear, so Heisenrader says she'll stick to what she knows best, cash or credit. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Stock of the day today, ticker symbol JCP, JCPenney, yes, of course, off 12.2%. The major indices, happily, didn't even notice. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Imagine a scenario where a giant storm hits New York City. Manhattan gets flooded, low-lying areas are pretty much wiped out. The power goes, people are out of their homes for months on end. Actually happened, right? Hurricane Sandy. Okay, now add this twist. A futures forecasting firm that makes a bunch of money predicting that exact disaster. And you've got the plot line of Nathaniel Rich's latest book. It's called Odds Against Tomorrow. It's fiction, I should tell you, but it reads real. Nathaniel, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I have to tell you, I've been trying to figure out what this book is about. Is it about statistical modeling? Is it about climate change? Is it about one kind of weird dude, Mitchell Zukor, your protagonist here? Is it about futures markets? I mean, there's a whole lot wrapped up in this book.
Well, it's about all of those things. I think if you have to narrow it down, I think it's about living in a culture in which we're constantly terrified by one piece of news after another. Whether or not you're looking for it, you know, it's in your Twitter feed and Facebook and your email. There is an obligation to write about what these things, these fears are doing to our personal lives and how they affect us and whether they're transforming us.
And you found this guy, you created this guy who has figured out when push comes to shove, a way to profit from it, right? I mean, he sort of doesn't want to do that. Mitchell Zukor doesn't, but he does because he's good at it.
Yeah, he's discovered a niche market and high stakes fear, essentially. He's selling a form of catastrophe insurance and profiting from it. You know, I started writing the book in 2007, and it was really only after 2008 and all of the news we read about what was happening in the banking world that I realized that aspect of the novel might have had greater resonance than I first imagined, because it's a very cynical sort of a scam business that he figures out.
The key sort of economic turning point in this book is this idea of corporate responsibility. I mean, people seek out your protagonist, Mitchell Zukor, because they want to lay off the risk of their liability in case something bad happens in the form of climate change or disaster or anything like that.
Yeah, it's just a short-term cynical thinking that I think is pretty common in high finance. And so he's profiting from disaster, but personally, he's horrified by this because he truly feels afraid of all these things that he's discovering in his research. And he's somewhat haunted by his colleagues who are merely using disaster as a kind of wedge to separate their clients from their money.
I wouldn't call the end of this one a happy ending, but life does come back. But it struck me that the life that comes back is different fundamentally somehow at the end of this book.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I absolutely did not want it to be a moralistic, pedantic ending. I feel like we're past the point of dystopian novels that carry with them a kind of a warning saying, you know, if we don't get our act together, this is what we're going to inherit, this horrible future. I feel like we're in that future to some extent already. I mean, we know what's happening with climate change. We know that there's all kinds of transformations going on in the environment, leaving aside, you know, other concerns about nuclear war and terrorism and so on. And the next phase for us is to understand how we can live in this new reality we've created. So the end of the novel, I think, has some ambivalence, and there's some hope, but there's also some real dread.
The latest book by Nathaniel Rich is called Odds Against Tomorrow. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've been going around the country since the beginning of the year, asking people to finish this sentence. You know you're wealthy when... Here's what some of the answers sounded like down in Dallas, Texas.
You know you're wealthy when you don't have to worry about livelihood. Some people get lucky. You're either born with it or you're not. And then the rest of us work or you luck at it.
You know you're wealthy when you shop at the mall every week.
You know you're wealthy when you wake up and you don't have to think. All you have to do is praise God.
You know you're wealthy when you're fishing with your boy.
You know you are wealthy when you can buy your own plane.
You know you're wealthy when you have no debt. We know we'll have made it when we paid off everything we need to pay off, so.
You know you are wealthy when you have a really good job. Because when you have a good job, like a doctor or something, and when you work hard, you get good money sometimes.
You know you're wealthy when you can quit your job on the spot.
Courtney Collins from KERA down in Dallas produced that piece for us. You can check out our map of answers from the rest of the country at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Supposedly, there's a warehouse in Brooklyn full of tiny little sort of quarter-sized antennas.
Small antennas, big problems for over-the-air broadcasters. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, now looky here. The Dow Industrials climbed 59 points, about 0.4%, closed at 14,613. The NASDAQ added 15 points, nearly a half percent, finished at 3,222. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, a third percent, 1563 at the bell there. Herbalife is at the center of a battle between two hedge fund managers, but today its shares took a hit from kind of out of left field. The accounting firm KPMG resigned as its auditor after firing a senior partner accused of providing insider trading tips. Stock was down nearly 4% today. KPMG, by the by, also resigned from Skechers, the sneaker maker. Skechers ran off, though. Its shares gained 1.8%. Bond prices fell a tad. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department releases its monthly statement for March. Maybe you've made new linens a part of your spring cleaning, something with flowers or bees or, ooh, sequins. Bed Bath & Beyond releases quarterly earnings. And F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby, was first published on April 10, 1925. Read it quick before the new movie version comes out. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Forget the television show The Biggest Loser. Forget corporate weight loss challenges. Try an entire city. You hear about that from time to time. An elected official gets it in his head that everybody needs to lose weight, and then he promptly challenges the constituents to a group diet. Trimming the fat helps the heart and re-election efforts, I guess. But commentator Beth Tytel notes that dropping the pounds is easier said than done.
Last April, my town's mayor challenged Bostonians to lose a collective 1 million pounds in a year's time. So far, 11 and a half months in, we've lost 96,000 pounds, only 904,000 to go by April 23rd. Fellow Bostonians, now would be a good time to start that juice fast. The mayor got the idea for a citywide diet after he met a very overweight boy while giving out Thanksgiving turkeys and worried that the child was doomed. He also thought we'd have an easier chance slimming down if we avoided Dunkin' Donuts together. It's not over until the fat lady sings, of course, but maybe the goal was just too ambitious. Perhaps a call to gain 1 million pounds would have better tapped into our strengths, or to rack up $1 million in parking tickets. But let's take a step back and examine the weight loss target. Why 1 million pounds? After all, Corpus Christi, Texas officials challenged their citizens to lose only 50,000 pounds, and that town was branded America's fattest city. Not to brag, but Boston recently made a list of the fittest cities. Even so, the Boston Public Health Commission figured that we have about 200,000 overweight or obese adults, and if each lost 5 pounds, we'd be set. But the commission wasn't going to be picky. Each of our 625,000 residents could lose 1.6 pounds, or one person could lose 1 million pounds. Actually, a dieter doesn't even need to live in Boston. The Boston Public Health Commission says it will take a pound of flesh from anyone who works, plays, or lives here. So, by all means, if you come into town for a Celtics game and you've had the stomach flu, please log on to the Boston Moves for Health website and share your loss. The city has worked hard to promote its program. It's offering free fitness classes and pedometers, deeply discounted memberships to Weight Watchers, coupons for healthy food, community walks, and other incentives. So what's going on? As a lifelong dieter, I see two possibilities. Either we're retaining water, or, even more likely, the scale is wrong.
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. For much of the past month or so, we, by which I mean the world's collective business press, has focused a lot of attention on Cyprus. Population something less than 1 million, economy something near 1/500th of the Eurozone's gross domestic product. All the while, a far larger problem lies unresolved. More than a month after Election Day, the Eurozone's third largest economy, Italy, has no government. The main political parties are still squabbling over the results, and yet international investors are unfazed. Italian borrowing costs have barely budged. The euro itself endures, which does oblige one to ask, does it not, whether Italy actually needs a government. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For more than a year, Italians lived with an unelected technocratic government that imposed austerity measures to bring down the deficit. Now they've voted for a new government, and we have to ask, have they gone completely mad? In the midst of a major economic crisis, a quarter of the electorate voted for this man, the crooning, much-indicted and discredited billionaire Silvio Berlusconi, while another 25% voted for a former stand-up comedian. E noi a gridare, guardate giù! No one tells them like Beppe Grillo, now leader of the Five Star Movement. Italy seems to have voted for a couple of clowns.
They're not clowns. They are political entrepreneurs.
James Walston of the American University in Rome.
They're extremely able politicians who have tapped into a constituency.
The third main party leader, the more serious Pierluigi Bersani, outpolled the other two but didn't get a majority. All three have, in their different ways, tapped into Italy's austerity fatigue. The people are fed up with public spending cuts and tax hikes. Can you blame them? Patrizio Nisirio of the Answer News Agency says those measures aren't working anywhere else.
They are not working in Greece, for sure. They are not working in the other southern European countries that are deep in crisis. So there is a sense there can be an easier way out of this.
But if a government actually came to power in Italy, committed to ending austerity, international investors might take fright and pull their money out. Italian borrowing costs could soar. Financial markets have remained calm since the election because the unelected technocrats are still in charge in a caretaker government. Michel Martone is a deputy minister.
It's very important to say to the financial community that the technocratic government is still in place, and we are very committed to respect all the budgetary limits that we had in Europe.
So the deadlock continues and the technocrats stay in power. It's worth asking, does Italy need an elected government? As the elected politicians bicker with each other, has the country stumbled on a brilliant way of venting popular discontent without causing turmoil in the financial markets? Maybe, but this is a democracy and the voters are not happy. I think the failure to form a government is a complete disgrace, says lawyer Elisabetta Girardi. Every day, as regular as clockwork, the Carabinieri band marches around the presidential palace, a show of discipline in the midst of this electoral turmoil. There could be fresh elections within a month, ending the deadlock and restoring political order. But ironically, that might also intensify the financial crisis. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Television is, as we all know, big business. Also, how we get our television is big business. Netflix, Hulu, HBO, Go, maybe. Innovations in broadcast are all the rage. But how about this? The good old-fashioned antenna. There's a new-ish company out there called Aereo that's banking on some supercharged rabbit ears to get itself a slice of the television pie. And that, in turn, has some network executives somewhat riled up. Peter Kafka is a senior editor at All Things Digital. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what this thing is, would you?
Oh, so well, it's supposedly there's a warehouse in Brooklyn full of tiny little sort of quarter-sized antennas, and the idea they got a whole array of these. And what's supposed to happen, and you'd probably be an engineer if you could understand this better, you tell Aereo, hey, I want to record something. It tells one of these antennas, hey, record this for Kai. It records a show and then transmits the show to you in almost real time. And then at some point, you're done using that antenna, and then it becomes someone else's antenna. So in theory, everyone's got a personal antenna. That's not really the case. You're sharing them. It's all quite complicated. A lot of people, frankly, didn't believe this technology could even work. There were some doubters. But they've since testified in court and showed pictures, and supposedly this thing does really exist.
So this is basically, well, I'm going to be pejorative here. It's a little bit of piracy, right, or no?
Well, that's the open question. They say they're absolutely not being pirates. What they're doing is doing what anyone with an antenna can do, which is take a signal off the public airwaves and use it to watch TV. They're not doing it the way anyone intended that to happen. They've got this whole system set up. It's certainly not what people thought about back in the day. But they've got an argument that so far the courts have blessed that says, nope, they do have the right to take a TV signal from the air and transmit it to you without paying a broadcaster for it, but charging a consumer for it.
So Aereo is going to make some money.
No idea.
well, in theory, right?
Even if the courts approve them, I'm not convinced this is a mainstream product. They obviously believe otherwise. But remember, what they're doing is giving you access to broadcast TV. That's four or five major networks and nothing else right now. I don't think most people who get cable TV would actually be satisfied with that, though.
Yeah. We should probably say at this point that this is a very, very small market device right now, right? It's only in New York City, and it has not yet spread.
New York City and the surrounding areas, and they're going to expand it to most of the country, or I think 22 markets this year.
Yeah. Do you think then that Fox and Univision are saber-rattling here, or are they really going to pull themselves off the broadcast airwaves and go to a cable system?
Oh, it's the definition of saber-rattling. Even if they wanted to take their ball and go home, they couldn't do so right away. What they're trying to do, it looks like, is sort of lay some preliminary groundwork for possibly seeking some sort of legislative relief if, in the end, the courts continue to uphold Aereo's legality.
Yeah. And I have to pay Aereo, what, $5 a month, $10 a month? What do I have to
pay? $8 to $12, I think. Uh-huh. I don't know the pricing in front of me. But and you can also sign up for $1 a day if you want. It's reasonably useful if there's a football game on, you're in a room that doesn't have a TV, but you do have an iPad. It works pretty well for those circumstances.
Have you tried it?
Yeah.
And?
Yeah, I wouldn't use it to. I've also walked down the street and tried to watch a football game. That's not ideal.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, the best thing you can do is sit in front of your TV with a DirecTV signal and watch that. But if you don't have that option or don't want to pay for that option, this is a pretty good alternative.
Peter Kafka, he's a senior editor at All Things Digital. Peter, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, reveals itself once again to be a bonehead. Louisville, as you know, won the men's basketball championship in Atlanta last night. The school's women play their final tonight in New Orleans. NCAA rules, though, see neither Louisville coach Rick Pitino, who, by the way, got a $425,000 bonus for the championship win, nor the school could pay for the men's team's players to go see the Louisville women. The NCAA did give a waiver this morning, which came too late, the school said, which I think stinks, because that would have been cool if they had gotten to go. All right, we have to go. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Tuesday. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, Lana Anwar, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.